Before we go on to liberalism on Monday, we'll have a question and answer. Because I think, and Barry said so too, that many of you want to reread Hegel over the weekend. I can't think of anything better to do for Halloween. So you might as well read Hegel, yes, instead of getting apples with razor blades in them. Well, one of you said at the end of the last hour, you see, that I had a very pessimistic view of life because I said all this about insoluble problems, trying to explain Hegel a little bit further. I do believe some problems are soluble, by the way, but I do think it's part of growing up to know that a lot of problems are insoluble. Yes, I think that's part of the growing up process. It comes hard, especially for Americans. Now, the reality, because you're still Enlightenment people, you see, you're not Hegelians. The reality is transient and always changing. But within that change, obviously, there is then a possibility of freedom, always unrealized. And all of this depends on these things then coming together. Coming together, the change and the freedom. Now, history obviously cannot be chaos, because otherwise there would be nothing to integrate yourself with. And therefore, a lot depends on the structure of reality, the structure of history. Because you can only integrate yourself with something that is structured. You cannot integrate yourself with chaos. It's clear. So that Hegel structures history. He structures it very carefully. He structured it through what we call the dialectic of history. That is to say, if human life evolves, as we said last time, between freedom and necessity, necessity being defined as the reality, the presence of history, and freedom being defined as the growth of your own self-consciousness, then the link must be clearly defined, and it is the dialectic and the unfolding of history. Because while your self-consciousness unfolds, history unfolds as well. But history unfolds according to a certain rhythm, which I can illustrate it this way by citing from Hegel himself. Inner progress. The Orientals have not attained the knowledge that mind, man as such, is free. And because they do not know this, they are not free. You see, it's always the mind that is primarily your self-consciousness. It isn't only freedom, but the knowledge of freedom. So your self-consciousness has to grow along with historical reality. So the Orientals have not attained the knowledge that man is free. And because they do not know it, they are not free. They only know that one is free, but that one is a despot, not a free man. The consciousness of freedom first arose among the Greeks. Here you see Hegel is 18th century, the worship of the Greeks. Told you about Winckelmann and Greek sculpture and the stereotypes and the myths. Here you have it from another angle. The idea of the consciousness of freedom first arose among the Greeks. And therefore they were free. But they and the Romans likewise knew only that some are free, not men as such. The Greeks therefore had slaves, and their whole life and the maintenance of their splendid liberty was implicated with the institution of slavery. So obviously, they only had a very partial freedom. The German nations, under the influence of Christianity, were the first to attain the consciousness that man as man is free. And that is the freedom of mind, which constitutes the essence. The essence of what? The essence of the progress of history. I'll come back to the German component in a minute. So Only the Germans had the idea that man is free because they had no slavery. And so the reality of history, in a way, interacts and makes it possible to have the true consciousness of freedom, which is that man is free. But this true consciousness of freedom evolves from the Orientals to the Greeks, to the Germans, to the present, and freedom always will out. Now, this then, the reality, history, must be brought in line with the development of human consciousness. That's the whole thing. The development of history towards freedom must be brought in line with the development of human consciousness towards freedom. They interact. Don't try and tear them apart, because the interaction here is the important thing. Therefore, there is always within reality, the world as it exists, reality that as it exists, a conflict between the potential of freedom and the reality, which has not yet attained to that potential. The present, therefore, is always in a way transparent with the future. The present always have that conflict, the idea of freedom wanting to be out. And man's self-consciousness must help along the idea of freedom by overcoming reality, by seeing further than reality, seeing further than the present, seeing through the present to a better future, that is, to a higher development of freedom. You can perhaps put it this way, that in a way, the present is always pregnant with the future. Reality is negative always for Hegel, as it will be for Marx. Reality is always negative. It is something to see through in this idea of progress. It is not something to stand on and to protect. It is always something to see through. Now, here is, of course, the revolutionary implication of Hegel, what got these young people of the 1840s so excited, as I said before. This idea that there is no status quo, there is no the present. The present is always pregnant with the future. And secondly, the future exists in essence in the present. And the problem is, as the future always exists latent in the present. The present is really like a pregnant woman, except that the baby isn't a baby, it's freedom. And freedom will out. And you have to have the kind of consciousness that you can see this baby and you will help its birth. This is the growth of your self-consciousness. But what does this consciousness mean? This consciousness means you see things ever more in a totality. You ever more appropriate the things that are yours. You evermore want an alienation, because you can only help the baby out if you see the totality. You see yourself, history, and the baby, the idea of freedom. You have to see things in a totality and not through the division of labor. Now that is crucial. You have to see it in a totality in order to help the future, which is always pregnant in the present. Man, therefore, must help to destroy the present. Man, in fact, helps to destroy the present here. This is, of course, what Hegel called world historical figures do. World historical figures like Napoleon and Caesar, they are the midwives. Whether they like it or not, they are the midwives. And here is what I said last time, the cunning of history. They are midwives whether they like it or not. But the true midwife has the right consciousness. But world historical figures are the midwives whether they like it or not. Page 38 of your reading, this is made clear, this whole business. The later universal, so to speak, the next higher genus of the preceding species is potentially not yet actually present in the preceding one. This makes all existing reality unstable and disunited. If you read the passage on page 38 of your Hegel reading, you will see what it means. He uses species very often for history. But what he means, one stage of history is higher. Therefore, the present is always unstable and disunited. And then he says on page 39, this is the result, on the one hand, of the inner development of the idea. That is to say, the baby that wants out, the idea, he assumes progress. The idea develops. And of the activity of individuals who are its agents and bring about its realization. That is to say, either world historical figures who are the agents even without knowing what they do, or better, people who have self-consciousness of the totality of things and who become the conscious agents of change, the conscious agents. Now, Caesar was not one of them. He couldn't be one of them. He was on a lower stage of history than the present. So obviously, Caesar could not have the self-consciousness that is possible now. And so on page 39, he says, thus Caesar, without changing the form of the constitution, became the sole ruler of the state. In accomplishing his original negative purpose, the autocracy of Rome, he at the same time fulfilled the necessary historical destiny of Rome and of the world. Thus he was motivated not by his private interest, but acted instinctively to bring to pass which the time required. Why? Because by having an autocracy, he brought about the Republic. He was murdered, and then came the Roman Republic. So, in other words, you get here the germ of something that becomes so central in Marxism, that you first have to bring about a certain anti-freedom, in a sense, to get the freedom. That as everything goes to freedom, even despots have their place on a lower stage of historical development. This becomes an absurd argument in 1933 when Stalin will argue that the Nazis must be supported by the communists, who supported the Nazis, of course, in Germany, because first there must be oppression and then there will be freedom. In other words, Hitler is a historical necessity, after which will come the classless society. But this is sort of built in all of Marxism, one of the fallacies, obviously. But it comes from Hegel that every world historical figure, everything in history has its place. There cannot be anything out of place. This is an extremely structured idea. So Caesar and Napoleon, whom Hegel hated, are world historical figures. They oppress only to awaken, if you like, without knowing what they're doing, so that they are what Hegel calls the creatures of the cunning of history. The creatures of the cunning of history. Now, obviously, what we have here is a certain rhythm of history. And that is the famous rhythm of the dialectic. Namely, that you have a thesis, an antithesis, and a synthesis before you go on, as it were, to a higher stage. That is to say, you have the thesis, the present reality. You have the Caesar or Napoleon who destroys the present reality. Destroys, perhaps too strong a word, I'll come back to that in a minute. Who destroys the present reality, leading to a higher synthesis. Both freedom has advanced more, human self-consciousness had advanced more to the next highest stage. Now, in all of this advancement to the stage, it's very well summarized, by the way, on page 95 of your reading, summarizes this very well, and summarized in one of the most famous passages from Hegel. Because it's again a passage about the cunning of history. Everything has its place. But the fruit does not fall back into the womb of a people which has produced and matured it. On the contrary, it turns into a bitter drink for this people. The people cannot abandon it, for it has an unquenchable thirst for it. But imbibing the drink is the drinker's destruction, and at the same time the rise of a new principle. What Hegel is saying here is very clear. Then here, you will never garner the fruit of your efforts. The fruit of your efforts are the destruction, in a sense, of what you have fought for, necessarily to destroy reality, your reality, in order to get to the next higher stage of the dialectic. And yet you cannot abandon your task of destroying reality, even though you want to preserve reality. It is a historical necessity, because the idea always pushes along to the next higher effort. And therefore, you have an unquenchable thirst for it. But imbibing the drink is the drinker's destruction. It is the destruction of reality and the rise of a new higher principle, the next on the historical ladder, if you like, the next way up on the historical ladder. Now, for Hegel, this dialectic was not a revolution. Hegel believed that it was gradual. And the word, the German word, which has unfortunately no English equivalent, which Hegel uses, is the word Aufheben, one part of the new Aufheben, the old. This is not a revolutionary vocabulary, but it means really making an end, but not a revolutionary end. It means really a kind of transition. So that for Hegel, the synthesis was always a compromise. Let me illustrate it this way. You have the old. You have the present reality. That is to say, the Roman state before Caesar. Caesar works within it, and he doesn't really want it, but he destroys it. And for Hegel, the new stage, the Roman Republic, would be a compromise. It would have a lot of the old in it and part of the new. The baby would never be entirely new, but it would take part of the mother with it, as it were. Now, obviously, the important thing is that because of that, Hegelianism could go two ways. It became a conservative principle, as you will see, but the young students of the 1840s, of whom Marx was a part, changed the dialectic to a revolutionary principle. They said, no, it isn't a compromise. The new will defeat the old. And how the old changes to the new is a struggle. It is a war. It is a war between the baby and his mother. And it will come out only in a warfare. A Caesarean is necessary always, say these new people, while Karl Marx thought in terms of a gentle kind of birth, while Hegel thought in terms of a gentle kind of birth, of a kind of compromise. As Bruno Bauer put it, perhaps the leader of this generation of the 1840s, of these radicals, the revolutionary elements in Hegel are hidden, and we must bring them out, as he put it in 1841. And we must bring them out. But I hope I have made clear more or less what these revolutionary elements are. The dialectic became changed. There's always the Aufheben. Marx talks about it too. Always the put to an end. Always the end of the old. But the end of the old here is a kind of compromise. This is highlighted or made still more clear by the old Hegel against the young Hegel. And there's much confusion here, so we must be clear about that. What excited Karl Marx was the young Hegel. The Hegel who essentially said in your reading that there is no end to this dialectic. It will go on and on till freedom is realized, but God knows when this will be. You don't know. Therefore, he has that famous line, which you're not going to like in the end, that happiness isn't the end of history. Because even if you have the self-consciousness, you'll never be happy. You're always destroying the reality. You're always destructive rather than constructive. You're always clearing the way for the idea, but that destroys your present reality. Therefore, happiness and contentment is not the end of history. Happiness is not the end of history. Yes? Because you're on a constant treadmill. And after all, Hegel was a Lutheran theologian. So he believed that the true harmony between your self-consciousness and freedom, that might be in another world. But you don't know when it is. You don't know when it is. Now, this, Hegel said, under the impact of the French Revolution, the impact of the future, the unknown future, the uncharted future. But he changed. And in his last work, The Philosophy of Right, he makes a very famous and fateful change. The state becomes the new form which established itself. Now, in a sense, that's part of the dialectic. You can say Napoleon destroyed. After all, the French Revolution and Napoleon destroyed the old reality, and what came out of it in the end is the state. You can say that. But Hegel went further, unfortunately. He believed that that was now the final agent of history. That is the way, under the influence of the German wars of liberation, under the influence of that Prussian nationalism, the Battle of Jena, where the Battle of Jena and of Leipzig, where the Prussians defeated the French of 1815. Heady wine for a Prussian to defeat the French is his, as if, let us say, the Afghans defeated the Russians, or let us say, Luxembourg defeated the United States, not quite as bad, but nearly as bad. In other words, it's heady wine. It's David and Goliath, all that sort of stuff. That's heady wine. And under that, Hegel, as so many people, changed their mind. And the Prussian state became the final good. Prussian state became the final good. But not, let us understand this clearly, the state as an institution. But the state as the Prussian state, as the best framework. He was always after structures, remember that. He wanted to structure everything so that your self-consciousness doesn't wander around. It has an aim. So the state as the framework in which spirit and reality can best coincide. In fact, what he says is that it is in the Prussian state that the best framework has been made to bring this treadmill to an end. The framework in which there is a possibility that your heightened self-consciousness and reality and history will coincide. That there is here that possibility in the Prussian state. You find that reflected in page 63 of your reading, when Hegel says, the state is the foundation and center of the other concrete aspects of national life, of art, law, morality, religion, and science. All spiritual activity, then, has the aim of becoming conscious of this union of freedom. So suddenly freedom is linked to the state. The universal, which appears and becomes known in the state, the form into which it casts all reality, is the culture of a nation, the spirit of the nation. To Hegel, the state is above all a cultural unit, a spiritual unit. It has to be that if it is to be the framework in which your self-consciousness and historical reality are going to coincide. It has to be a spirit as well, a spirit which makes possible this kind coinciding. The state's culture, the state's morality, the state's religion, has to make this kind of coinciding, after all, possible. Let us remember that. Now, what then is the ideal state, the Prussian state? How then does Hegel view the Prussian state, which makes this kind of possible? And here I must go to a passage which is not in your reading. A state is well constituted, he writes, and eternally powerful when the private interests of its citizen is at one with the common interests of the state. That's necessary. Your self-consciousness must interact with reality. Private interest must coincide with common interests. When the one finds its gratification and realization in the other, a proposition in itself, very important. But in a state, many institutions must be adopted and much political machinery invented, accompanied by appropriate political arrangements, involving the contentions with private interest and passions, a tedious discipline. In other words, the state must have some structure and such discipline. Now, what is the structure and discipline of Hegel's state? Because, as he puts it again, it is necessary to put a constraint upon impulse, desire, passion. And that doesn't limit freedom, it makes it possible. Because Hegel, like everybody else, was afraid of passions. And he thought, that doesn't limit freedom. But in order to have the synthesis, the final synthesis, the coinciding of your self-consciousness and reality, reason is necessary. Reason. You mustn't lose sight of this. Hegel thought this was a rational structure. And therefore, the passions have to be excluded from the final synthesis. Caesar still had passion. The ancients still had passion. Even the Greeks who kept slaves still had passion. But in the final synthesis, it must be based on reason, not passion, obviously. The reality, the historical reality, and your self-consciousness. The state, therefore, which he proposes, is in fact the liberal state. The state he proposes is a state of laws, rather than a man of legally guaranteed freedom, the liberal state. And in his glorification of Prussia, that is often overlooked. He wanted a liberal state. He believed in fact, and with some justice, by the way, which is also overlooked, that the Prussian state, in fact, was largely a state of laws. However much power it gave to the king, and however much an autocrat, the new Prussian king, Frederick William IV, was to be. This could not have been foreseen in 1821 yet, that the new king of Prussia, Frederick William IV, was to be an autocrat. But there was a great deal of hope in 1821 that Prussia indeed would become a state of law. That is always forgotten in this view of Prussia. So that we must say in this regard that, first of all, the state of Hegel is a liberal state. And therefore, these laws, he thought, make possible a rational approach. It makes possible an atmosphere of reason, in which your self-consciousness and historical reality, the state, will come to a harmonious compromise. That's one thing that must be said. But a second thing I must be said also. Hegel nowhere says that this compromise will be final. In other words, it's not at all sure whether in Hegel's ideal state the individual and the community will not clash. The state and the individual will clash. Hegel certainly believed that, because otherwise there would be no use of laws. In other words, this isn't a Rousseau idea that you read. This isn't the government of Poland, where man is thought to be basically good And therefore, if you appeal to his right spirit, you will have the ideal state. Hegel was a Lutheran theologian. Hegel believed in original sin. Hegel didn't have this foolish idea that men are good. He still believed in that quite proper and obviously correct doctrine of original sin, yes? Well, obviously, if history has proved something, it's proved that. Yes. Why would people put razor blades in apples otherwise? So obviously, there is original sin. And so Hegel believed that even at a time when human self-consciousness is the furthest developed, if you like, yes? It's the furthest developed. And men can see things in a totality. They can see the totality. Historical reality must be rational. And rational historical reality, which he saw in the Prussian state, must include laws, because obviously there are people who are always irrational. There is always what the Puritans call the old Adam in us. There is always the old Adam in us. So even freedom realized will be freedom realized in a society of men. In the society of Christians, Hegel would say. In a society of Christians. So that, in other words, this is the famous Hegelian state. This is the famous Hegelian state. It is not an autocracy. It is not a state, a Prussia of the autocrat Frederick William IV. It is the Prussia of the Prussian reform movement, technically speaking. The Prussia of Hardenberg, von Stein, and the laws of the Prussian reform movement before that movement had been defeated that Hegel had in view. But you can see, too, why Hegel was called to be rector of the newly founded University of Berlin after Fichte. Why the Prussian authorities thought here they had a man who could stop student unrest. Because after all, Fichte, the fraternity movement, remember, all this student agitation, this student agitation for German unity, all this student unrest, which they liked no better in 1810 than authority liked it in 1968. So that they called Hegel successfully to put an end to student unrest for two reasons. First of all, Hegel didn't believe in German unification. He believed in the Prussian state. And so he was obviously for them the right man at the right place as rector of this new and rather disturbed university. And secondly, Hegel believed in a state of laws. And again, that would exclude the passions of men. So he was obviously the right person to stop that student unrest with the help of a little police and other things, of course. Without saying, but he did, and he managed to do it. Now then, in all of this, then, the dialectic in Hegel has a precarious balance in the Prussian state, only in the old Hegel, not in the young Hegel. The dialectic, however, is never overtly revolutionary. Because Hegel thought of it then as a kind of compromise, but the new would always defeat the end. Perhaps I can sum it up again, because this will be most difficult in your reading. If you come to 30a in page 33, where Hegel says, one may contemplate history from the point of view of happiness. But actually, history is not the soil of happiness. The periods of happiness are blank pages in it. Why? Because it's the labor of Sisyphus. It is the labor of Sisyphus, essentially. Essentially, even if you have consciousness of the totality, there will always be latent a higher development of self-consciousness. Yes? And even if you have destroyed the unpalatable present and consciously helped to destroy it, not like Caesar, but consciously helped to destroy it, there will always be what you will have brought to fruit will be a bitter fruit, because itself will always be subject to destruction. Now, of course, Marx had to change that, because that would be true of the classless society, yes? It would be true of the dictatorship, it would be true of everything, it's transparent. So obviously the radicals had to change it, because young people cannot take this sort of thing. Young people have to see an end. They have to work for something which will last, not something that is transparent, negative, something that will last. And perhaps Hegel himself had that feeling that in his old age he put forward the Prussian state as a framework that will last. Because if you take Hegel as these young people took him, there is no happiness. There is no happiness in history. There cannot be any happiness. In fact, history is the force which the happiness are, as Hegel says, blank pages in it. You will not be surprised that I used that famous line of Hegel to conclude a large book I once wrote about European culture, will you? So what you have, therefore, is that what you have here then is no happiness. You have it. Now, in Hegel, there are three implications, three movements that you can have, three ways that you can go or that people went. You may find more. Three ways that people went. Either you can take Hegel's ideal state as the kind of synthesis, and through the framework of the state say, in effect, that history is progress. There is no resting place. The only resting place is in laws, and eventually in morality. That'll be the liberal way. That'll be the liberal way. And that is what we come to on Monday and after our question period. That's the first way to go, with the liberal state, which also believes that there's no resting place. That's its disadvantage as over young people. There is no utopia. There is only always a greater progress to some kind of freedom within the framework of laws. But of course, what makes that possible in liberalism is the morality. So we shall first go to liberalism. Secondly, there is, of course, the conservative implication, which I won't do much. It's so obvious that as history is necessity, everything that is just. Therefore, you must support the existing and fight the existing and keep everything new from happening. President Reagan is a Hegelian. He doesn't know it. You must keep everything new from happening, because you can't. You're doomed to destruction, of course. But never mind. Conservatism, this kind of conservatism, that everything that is good, you must keep it if possible. In other words, that the way to cope with reality is to keep the present, because there is a historical necessity for it. Everything that is good. And the third way is to turn it in a revolutionary direction, to say that the dialectic is not a compromise, but a revolution. That there will be a final synthesis, but that final synthesis against the thesis, antithesis, the final synthesis will not be the Prussian state, but come out of a revolution will be the classless society. A synthesis, however, which almost in the Hegelian manner you cannot define. Where you hunt in the afternoon and fish in the morning, I always get it wrong. You do something or other. It's really rather uninteresting. It just shows that you can't define this kind of thing. So you can turn it in a revolutionary direction, which of course Karl Marx did. Now, in these consequences of Hegel, you may ask again, and I want to end with that before I ask questions, that from what I have said and what you read, I hope you can understand the great paradox which I told you at the beginning, that this man, who never wrote much, what you read are the notes of his students. His students published his lectures after his death. He never wrote much. Who didn't have more than three or four students because he was so dull and ununderstandable. That he could have had this enormous consequence, that the system of Hegel is more important than Aristotle, vastly more important, for modern times. That it is what Aristotle was for the classics, in a sense. Hegel is for modern times. That it is a system which has not ceased to stir the spirits of modern times to this day because of its ingredients. First of all, I hope you see the combination of the past, the summarization, the organic growth, which we've talked about in nationalism and romanticism, the emphasis on reason, which we've talked about so much in the Enlightenment, or I should say the emphasis on reason and progress, progress as a necessity, so deeply embedded in the Enlightenment. Putting those together, and putting them together in the end also with nationalism, with the Prussian state, but not necessarily, so that you have a synthesis. Secondly, you have in Hegel, after all, a combination of two very profound trends, which are always in contradiction. The trend of the individual and the quest for making your life meaningful as an individual, and the quest for community, and community defined in historical terms. That is to say, how can the individual join himself to this bewildering history which you can't control, which seems to go on? You've lost your control over your destiny. You're just a little cog in a machine, as you say. Yes, dehumanizing. University of Wisconsin buildings should help to get you totally dehumanized. If you're not already, especially the building we're in. So that, I'm quite serious, so that dehumanizing, the bigness, education, after all, is today dehumanized. We're living, universities are no longer universities, they're corporations, and they act as such. So what you have, the ever greater bigness, the dehumanizing, and Hegel answers it for you, He says, in fact, you can change it if you understand it. And you can understand it because there's a rhythm to it, the rhythm of the dialectic, If you understand it, and if you see it as a totality, then you can join yourself to history. Now, there is a presupposition to which you must agree. It only works if you agree that history works that way. In other words, if you don't think there is a historical dialectic, if you don't think there is progress, if you don't think that the new always will out, and let us say, Mr. Reagan is a world historical figure who's bringing, as it were, out the new, then, of course, the whole thing doesn't work. There are presuppositions of reason, of romanticism, but above all, the presupposition that history works that way. But if you don't believe history works that way, of course, you can't be a Marxist either. It's quite clear. They all are a presupposition on the basis of history, and, of course, history doesn't work that way. But that's not important for us, because people thought it worked that way. Therefore, it influenced man's minds and thought structure. But of course, it's nonsense historically. We all know that. No, we don't all know that, unfortunately, but it is, of course, utter nonsense. So the basic is flawed. You'll see that with Marx, that man is a reasonable creature. The basis is flawed. Here, Hegel is less flawed than Marx, because he at least believes in original sin, and then doesn't have Marx's very dated presupposition, so dated that Lenin has to change it completely. So, because Bolshevism is certainly based on the idea that men are also not reasonable and they have to be They have to be manipulated and they have to be reigned through terror to a certain extent. Well, Marx has none of that at all, as you will see. So he has this kind of basis, so that you have a kind of salvation. Finally, you have with Hegel what people longed for in the age of industrialization, a structure. Everything is structured. And everything comes together in a definite structure, so that there is not chaos, but structure. Now, all of these things come together in Hegelianism. And all of this make a system. They give you what I like to call a fully furnished house at the beginning of modernity. And at the beginning of modernity, it becomes clear that that is what bewildered people want. When their factories were their fields, when people think they've lost control of their own destiny, when there are political, social, and economic crises, when you don't know what the hell is going on. What people want is answers, a totality. They want a totality. They reach out for a totality. Some kind of process of integration between themselves and the community, in nationalism, between themselves and history. And history is a wonderful thing to integrate with, especially if you're bewildered. You integrate with it in nationalism through the worship of your ancestors, through doing folk dances and other things. But the great thing about Hegel is you integrate with it through the growth of your self-consciousness. That is, in my opinion, quite a different kind of level than doing these folk dances and torchlight parades and that sort of thing. Because for Hegel, in the last resort, matters are a thing of the mind, are a thing of the mind, are a thing of the mind. And in a sense, Karl Marx not only stood Hegel on his head, as it is said, but he brought him down to earth. He brought him down to earth as well by introducing factors which go beyond the mind, if you like, beyond the mind, however disputed they are, we shall see, which go beyond the mind to a reality which isn't entirely the reality of human perceptions. You see that with Hegel, what matters are human perceptions, and they do matter. You are not what you eat. You are what you perceive yourself to be, obviously. But there is a reality, and the reality is not just a matter of perception. It is obviously a matter of existence apart from your perceptions, and obviously some of it is very difficult to manipulate, even if you see the totality. Now, with all of this said, I think we are going to have a question and answer session on Monday. So take the advantage of the weekend to look at Hegel again, and I will try to answer any questions you have on Monday.